direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe, it's the Raleigh James Show.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and if it's on your mind, it'll be on mine. But for this hour, we're going to talk to Charlie Gracie Jr. again. We talked to him a few months ago, but I was hearing the other night about the Forever Fabulous. Well, I don't want to call it an exhibit. It was actually, and I don't want to call it a memorial either, because that's not really true. It was a celebration. As you know, Charlie died in December, and of course, there was a service that was, as you would expect, spiritual, somber, and all the things it should be. But I know that Charlie Jr. and his mom Joan and others said, you know, there should be a celebration that's you know, more about his career and his music and uplifting and things of that nature. And what's interesting about this, and it was a sellout crowd, by the way, in media, is that it's timed with an exhibit at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. As I've mentioned many times, I use Charlie as an example of what's wrong with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because he's not yet in it. However, a step in the right direction, they've put a Rave On exhibit together, and it features some of the early giants of rock and roll, none more giant than Charlie Gracie Jr. and Charlie Gracie. So Charlie Gracie Jr. joins us to talk about that. Thanks for letting us know, Charlie. How are you?
And greetings from soggy, wet, the soggy, wet greater Philadelphia area. We've been deluged with rain the last week. It's been unbelievable.
Well, it's summer. You know how it is. I mean, you'll get that. Yeah. And then you'll have some beautiful days, too.
Everything seems to be going to such extremes. We had a drought in May. A drop of rain in May. It might have been the driest May in Philadelphia history in this area. But then from that extreme to this,
yeah.
So I guess we're making up for it now in spades, right?
Well, was it raining? Was it raining Friday night when you did the
trip? Actually, you know what? It was sort of overcast, and then around 3 or 4 o'clock, it came down cats and dogs. So I said, oh my gosh. So, you know, it's funny, thinking ahead and being aware of the weather forecast in the long distance, I overbooked the room purposely. I figured, well, some people probably aren't going to come out. So that actually worked, because we did have a full house. And the rain stopped about maybe 2 hours before the program began. Mm. So it was great. And it was dry, and the sun actually was poking out of the clouds by the time we began, around 6:37. So it was good.
Well,
yeah, it was dry.
The heavens were crying, is the deal, and it cleared up just in advance. You know, it's interesting about the Rave On display, and of course Charlie shares that with Gene Vincent and Buddy Holly and who else? Bo Diddley.
All
of them deservedly so. But interestingly, Charlie, more than anyone else in that group, had to span the era when he started, which really was still pop standards, to full-fledged rock and roll. And considering he released his first records in 1953, very few people were able to make it into rock and roll. And he was certainly one of them. So hopefully the exhibit is bringing that up.
Well, we'll see. I think I mentioned the last time I was on the program, about 48 hours after my father had passed, Greg Harris, the CEO and president, called me. He had my number from a previous engagement we had done with them in 2018 before the pandemic hit. My father performed for them and spoke to their board of trustees, and they came to the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia for a four-day retreat. And I think he left an impression, not only speaking to the board, but also performing for them. So he called and said, you know, we need to do something for your dad, and I want to do it soon. And I said, well, Greg, what do you have in mind? He said, well, the guitar, that's the first thing that comes to mind. Your father allowed me to hold that artifact that precious artifact. And I'm like, yeah. I said, he's played that for more than six decades all around the world, from the smallest venue to the largest. And he said, well, we'd love to have that, and maybe a suit of clothing, some original photographs, maybe some records, whatever you can come up with. So we arranged for a trip to go out there in March. We spent 4 days in Cleveland. By the way, I was pleasantly surprised with the city of Cleveland. We were there. My wife Kim and I went out there in 2020 in August for about a week, and we went to the Hall of Fame that summer and actually got to, you know, check out Cleveland. I'll tell you, it's really a nice city. So many people have left that town, but it's a beautiful city. And I found it to be clean, and the people to be very nice, and the Hall of Fame is really something to see. I know it's not the perfect museum, and people have their gripes with it, but it is a place to you should check out, and there's a lot of history in there, and many artifacts from some of your favorite performers. So we enjoyed it, and we were given the VIP treatment. Raleigh, my mom, my wife, and I, and we even brought the dog with us.
Oh, that's great.
Although Rocky had a babysitter, though. I have friends that live in Cleveland that watched our dog, our little Pomeranian, for a few hours while we took the tour. But we went into the archives, and lo and behold, not only was Charlie Gracie's guitar sitting there, but a dress had just arrived from soon-to-be late Tina Turner. This is March now. She was still living. She was still with us then. A suit of one of Elvis Presley's army uniforms had arrived, another one. I'm trying to think, an outfit worn by James Brown, and maybe something that Cyndi Lauper had worn. She was nominated this year, by the way, and did not get in. So it was interesting to be in that room, and it's climate controlled. It's very dry, and you see all of the wardrobe hanging up in these special, closets and things like that. And he said, yeah, you know, and we treat these things, very carefully, and they all have these blue gloves on, I shot some video back there, and he said, your dad's gonna be reunited with all the guys that he toured with, Buddy Hollies and the Eddie Cochran's and Chuck Berry and all those guys. So we were thrilled. He showed us the place where it would go, and we were given a tour, and it was wonderful. It was my mom was very emotional when we had to turn the guitar over.
Of course,
I bent over and kissed it, and somebody grabbed a picture of me doing that, and the papers publicized it, but. You know, it's a loan. They're going to have it for at least 3 years, and we'll probably renew it for another three. And then by that time, if I'm still around and we're still around, we'll hopefully make it permanent, I think, because really, if we have this instrument in the house, it's going to go back in the case and probably sit in the closet somewhere, and who's really going to get to enjoy it? So hundreds
great.
Or thousands of people go through that building every year, and they'll see it'll be on display. And in a sense, Charlie Gracie will still be on stage.
Right.
Or at least his artifacts will be.
Absolutely. Now, his iconic salmon suit, I understand, will at some point join the display.
Mm-hmm. It is, yes. They would like that. So we're making arrangements to send that out. Yep, we are.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. That's terrific. And like you say, the Hall of Fame has its attractors for all the right reasons. But this is this is huge. And I think back, because anybody who is a fan of Charlie Gracie and knows his story knows that his integrity killed him damn near. When he wasn't getting any royalties at all, he brought suit. And he got $50,000, but he also lost his career in the process. Nobody stateside would in fact hire him. But what's interesting is that he wound up on some European tours. Now, by the way, I never asked you this. Since he became, Peck's bad boy here in persona non grata, who booked him in Great Britain and why?
Well, he was hot in the spring and summer of 57.
Sure.
Butterfly went to number one, and it was Fabulous, made the top 20. And then some of his records started charting over in the UK. Elvis had never toured there. And never toured there his entire career. And
right.
He died. He never got over to the UK because of Colonel Parker's technicalities with his lack of citizenship or whatever the deal was with him. But so I think they were eager to there was a great appetite to get to see some American rockers. So my dad's agent, Bernie Rothbard, who had already been booking him before he became, popular. My dad was kind of a local celebrity at that time, working a lot of the clubs and showrooms.
Sure.
The offer came over, and I think Bernie said, look, Charlie, the Cameo Records is not paying you. They're giving you a pittance as far as royalties go. here's your chance to make some big money. You know, I just got a call from the Willard Alexander Agency, and Lou and Leslie Gray, who were honored by the Queen later on. They want to book you, and here's a chance to make like $5,000 a week. You're going to start out with the Hippodrome, which is one of the great show places of the world, and you'll work the provinces. You'll be there for at least, I think the initial tour was supposed to be for 5 weeks, and then they extended. It was so successful, it was extended to 8. And he made quite an impact. And then, you know, a lot of the early rock and roll singers, you know, they played the guitar, but not very well. They were tepid strummers, and like Bill Haley, even Elvis to a certain extent. Sorry to say, he wasn't much of a guitar player. When my father got on stage and showed him what he could do with that instrument, it blew people away. And even the critics who were not so keen on rock and roll and rock and rollers at that time had to admit, you know, the guy really, you know, he's a presence on stage. He's a showman for a 21-year-old. He was able to handle it. In fact, Greg Harris, the president of the Hall of Fame, had just come back from England. They dedicated a plaque at the Bristol Hippodrome for Eddie Cochran. That was the last venue Eddie played before he was killed in that car accident back in 1960. And he said, you know, we were in London the first couple of days, Charlie. He said, I went by the Hippodrome. He goes, that is a humongous, it's a block long. He said, I thought of your dad, 21 years old, headlining a place like that. How intimidating that must have been. But really it wasn't, because my father was ready for the shot. He had already been playing for 4 or 5, 6 years, you know, around the Philadelphia area, and actually going to places like Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Toledo, and kind of like playing. And, you know, you had variety back then. So you had dancers, you had comedians, you had singers. And so my father was already playing the circuit, trying to build a reputation, build a name for himself, without any hits at that point, but still playing. And so he was ready. He was ready for the shot when it came. And they had to admit, the critics said, well, this little guy, you know, he's a showman. He can really hold the audience together. And they had to admit that he had that gift. So he was booked back even the following year, once he was on the outs with Cameo and had no hits at 58. They booked him back again, simply on the strength of the impact that he made the year before. And he did another, I think, 5-week tour, playing pretty much the same, you know, the Moss Empire Theater chain, these big old theaters that hold maybe, I don't know, anywhere from 1,500 to 3,500. And pretty much all of them were sold out, you know, or close to it. And so he pretty much, you know, laid down some tracks in the UK. And then, you know, after he got blacklisted and came back to home and pretty much became a regional performer here in the Philadelphia Tri-State area, when the shot came for him to go back again in the late 1970s, he returned and after a 21-year absence, and then never looked back. He performed there almost every year, I think, from 1979 through the pandemic, through 2019, before the pandemic struck. Over 40 tours in the UK alone.
Well, exactly. So, and I'm glad you explained it that way, because when I ask in terms of how did he get booked over there, I knew the first tour, of course, on the strength of the hits. But Cameo went out of their way, as you well know, to blacklist him every way they could. And what I thought was interesting is it did not work overseas. They said, hey, the guy sells, people like him, we're bringing him back. And
they were foolish, because the records were selling in the UK, too. They charted fairly high over there. So. My dad's agent thought, here's a chance for you to make some money. And Cameo was not happy with the fact that he went over there for such a long period of time. They said, well, he's not going to be in the States to promote, you know, the follow-up singles, the Fabulous Wandering Eyes, I Love You So Much It Hurts, and some of the others. But, you know, Bernie said to Bernie Lowe, who owned Cameo, said, well, look, his records are selling this. What's the difference? So just have the records available to the record by the public, and you're going to make money there, too. And they did.
Yeah, you know, I think they did to some extent. Their distribution deals weren't quite as favorable, so I'm sure that's why Bernie was, saying, get them here.
Yeah.
But regardless, and you also touched on the guitar work, and I think that's really key, because when you have people like Paul McCartney or Graham Nash and many, many others, Van Morrison, on and on, waxing sentimental, it isn't because Charlie sang Fabulous or Butterfly, though they're great. It's because they saw guitar work in a way that they'd never seen it.
Yeah, well, you know Harvey Holiday right here in Philadelphia.
Oh, sure.
He's a very well-known DJ. Harvey called me up the night about 2 months ago. Said, you know, I was watching some videos of your father. You know, Butterfly was the number one record, and Fabulous did pretty well here too, and then the other hits. He said, but really, those records do not reflect your father's ability as a showman and as a performer. He said, you know, really, it's the impact was not because of the hits. The hits are great, but the impact was his showmanship and his ability on the guitar. That's what you know, Paul McCartney noticed. And of course, they were teenagers. What did they know? But they realized there was some spark in this guy, and they remembered it all these years because my dad met them later. They said, Charlie, we'll never forget you playing Guitar Boogie, or, you know, doing this on stage or that on stage. And we were starstruck. We were probably 6-7 years younger than you at the time, and that's what we wanted to do. We saw you, and just it inspired us to want to get up there and do the same thing. So yeah, you're right, Raleigh. It's his musicianship that really carried the day and got him the kudos from all these people. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, because the guitar work, again, you can't overstate how important that was, because we take it for granted now. There's a ton of rock and roll guitarists and all this kind of stuff, but you literally weren't hearing this when Charlie started at all. And so these guys, some of whom could play the guitar and others wanted to play the guitar, you know, but they were able to hear things that they might not have thought of on their own in terms of licks and things like that. And, you know, I think to his last show, Charlie always had a segment where he, you know, highlighted the guitar, and it was truly wonderful. Now this exhibit is so great because I remember stateside, unfortunately, how successful Bernie Lowe and et al. from Cameo were in blackballing Charlie, because for years he literally couldn't get arrested, even in Philadelphia, not like it was. And here we are now in 2023, and it's a sellout crowd and media. So that that is great.
Yeah, we were looking for a venue to celebrate his life, and we had video tributes. We showed some old videos of Dad, like on Ed Sullivan and Jamboree, and Dad receiving his bronze plaque on the Philadelphia Walk of Fame on Broad Street. With there's over 100 Philadelphia acts, from dancers to comedians to actors and musicians honored on the Walk of Fame downtown. You know, by the way, before you called me, Raleigh, I was on the phone with Caesar Berry of the time.
Oh, I love Caesar. How is he?
And he sends his love and to you and John. And
I do too.
Doing well.
They're
great guys.
You'll have to get John his number, because I haven't talked to him in so long, and I think of him often.
Absolutely.
And we should have him on.
You should.
Yeah.
And they were just honored on the Walk of Fame back in April. We attended a gala down on Broad Street, and the Bacon Brothers were inducted into the Walk of Fame, and a few others.
Perfect.
But they were finally inducted. It was long overdue, and it was a beautiful event. And also they honored my dad and Bobby Rydell and Len Barry, who passed not so long ago too, at the same venue. And they're on the Walk of Fame. So at the show on Friday, the Times came on Friday night, and they performed a cappella. They did So Much in Love and Wonderful, Wonderful.
Yeah.
And the crowd loved it. It was great. And they brought the house down, and they look good, and they sound good, and they brought their wives, and the theater folks said to us, you know, we've been working here probably 20 years, we've never seen a more loving and adoring crowd gather in this place for such a great purpose. And we ran over an hour and a half, you know, during our time.
Wow!
But they said, no, we're just sitting back and we're enjoying the show. This is really amazing, and we're mesmerized. And and then, of course, the last hour or so, we had live music, and there were a couple of different bands, and my father's band played as well. And then it was just, I have to send it to you, Rod. There's a half-hour video memorial that was done. It's really beautiful, and it's very moving. I'll have to send you a copy of it.
I'd love to hear it
too, but you'll love it. It starts out with Dad's very youngest pictures as a baby and goes all through his career.
Perfect.
It's an emotional ride, I have to tell you. Even Greg Harris said, I need a copy of that. I said,
you'll get one, no problem. You betcha. We're talking to Charlie Jr. That's Charlie Gracie Jr. about Charlie Gracie. And if you got any questions, especially if, and I know if you're a long of tooth like the rest of us, you were a fan back in the day. It was impossible not to be. But by all means, we got the guy who can answer them. 888-876-5593 on WGN Radio.
In his hands, I keep some love in my heart. I try to do my best, and I try to do my part. But sometimes I tend to doubt myself. So I turn to heaven, and help. I keep an angel on my shoulder, and the Lord, he's got my back. And when I get off course, well, the Lord, he brings me back. I keep an angel on my shoulder, and the Lord has got my back. Well, I read the gospel word, and I know the scriptures well. I plan to follow them to save my soul from hell. But sometimes I tend to lose my way, so I drop down on my knee, I hang my head, and I pray.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. We're raunchy licking that. And that of Charlie Gracie, probably like you've never heard him, but that came out not that long ago in the last decade, 2015, on Lanark Records. I thought that was just terrific. Did Charlie write that?
No, as a matter of fact, one of the bands that performed Friday night at the Memorial Celebration, Raleigh, was Quinton Jones out of Lancaster, PA. He owned the Lanark record label, and he plays the rockabilly circuit a lot with people like Jerry Lee Lewis, his sister Linda Gale, and others, you know, Nick Keane and people like that. He played with Robert Gordon. He signed my dad to a contract years ago, and they did two albums. One was called I'm All Right, which came out, I think, in 2000 or 2001. And then the second one they did, I guess, like you said, 2015, and Angel on My Shoulder. And my dad said he wanted to do some country and some gospel, or country gospel slash gospel. So there you hear the results of it. And let's see, Dad was probably only about maybe 77 there.
Right. But I thought that was just a great song.
I
think with the right kind of promotion, that could have gotten a lot of airplay. And it didn't, which is a shame.
Absolutely, sure.
Yeah, it was.
But again, it just shows that he was versatile. He could play anything, pretty much anything, you know. And Quentin was at the show on Friday and put on quite a display. Quentin's quite a guitar player himself. In fact, even Greg Harris of the Hall of Fame was like, "Yeah, Quentin was unbelievable." Got out there and he just blew them away. And he said, "The one thing your father taught me," he said, "you know, I was a young, sort of little bit stuck up musician. I knew it was good, and I would often come out and." You know, and not really engage the crowd. Your father told me, you know, you may be good, but people don't know who you are. You have to come out. You want to build a following. You have to speak to your audience, talk to them, engage them. And I noticed that night. It's amazing. Even my mom said, you know, Quentin has come a long way in 20 years since your father began working with him. I mean, he's a great musician. Don't get me wrong, but he became a performer, and he became the kind of guy that will connect with the audience, and that's what will give you a career. People will come back and see you all the time if you make them feel like you're part of the action. And he's doing it beautifully. So it was just so nice to see that, you know?
You're so right about that, and there was no better example of that than Las Vegas, where you'd have people who had hit after hit who could not really make it in Vegas, and then you'd have a guy like Wayne Newton who couldn't have a hit to save his soul after Donkashane, but was absolutely record-breaking for decades in Vegas because he was just that, an entertainer. So who did write Angel on My Shoulder?
I believe it was Quentin Jones.
Oh, wow.
Quentin and maybe another. Yeah, I don't have the CD in front of me, but pretty sure that I'm pretty sure he wrote it. Yeah.
When I was looking at the display, and that's up now, the Rave On display at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and will be there at least the next 3 years and probably renewed after that. But I looked at Gene Vincent and kind of juxtaposed him with your dad, because the thing that your dad had, which was unseen, was an incredible family. Your mom, Joan, just a rock, and then a tribute to them both is you, Charlie Jr., and your sister. I mean, he had... whether it was a lean year or not, he had the kind of grounding that could get him through anything. Now, you look at that by comparison. Gene Vincent, granted, he died young, bleeding ulcers at 71. He was 36 years old, 1971. But I thought to myself, wonder where they got this stuff. What's the Gene Vincent estate? I have no idea who even, you know, because I know a good friend of mine, Tex Davis, was his manager for years, but Tex is long gone, and I think one of the Blue Caps, Dickie Harrell, still alive, but everybody else is long gone.
Actually,
so.
Raleigh, he passed about a month ago. Dickie's gone.
Oh.
He just passed. Yes, he did. And he was the Facebook friend. We used to communicate on my dad's Facebook site. Yep.
You know,
I
was thinking about him recently because after the last move, I never had gotten him a change of address, so I stopped getting his Christmas cards. And it's the only time I'd hear from Dickie Harrell. But hey, once a year, I knew he was doing well, and I'm so sorry to hear that he's no longer with us. So that's all of the Blue Caps then, because sadly, Wee Willie Williams died in '99, accidentally shot himself to death, and on and on it goes. But in all seriousness, obviously, Greg in the hall can come to your mom, can come to you, can get all the information they ever want on Charlie. Who do you go to for Gene Vincent?
I don't know.
I don't either.
And he's still an icon over in the UK. He's still an icon there. You know, he's up there with Eddie Cochran. And, and I think Dying Young, I think, kind of builds
that
iconic image, too, for them, you know, not being around.
Well,
to grow old they remain forever young. But Gene had a sort of a sad ending too, and he was a great performer also. He really did. Again, he was something to behold, and he didn't have all that many hit records, I don't think.
No,
after Bebop and Louie, a lot of love, and then a few lesser ones. But I mean, he was someone that you had to go and see. He was a great performer, and again, knew how to reach out and grab the crowd's attention, and that image of the rebel and the greased back hair, leather jackets, and all that stuff just. I know it had an effect on the Beatles, too. So,
sure.
You know, the young Beatles coming up.
Well, it's interesting you mention the fact that they die young because no slight intended, but we all say probably wouldn't have been pretty if Buddy Holly lived to be an old man. You know, now I don't know if that's true or not, but we all kind of, are able to enshrine him at the peak of his life, you know.
Yes.
And Gene Vincent, of course.
You know what's funny, Raleigh? My dad never met Buddy Holly nor Elvis.
Right.
And I said, well, Dad, if you had the choice of meeting one over the other, he said, you know what? I think I would have enjoyed meeting. Of course, Elvis was the king. I'm not taking anything away from him. But Buddy Holly was the guy that really intrigued me because he was a musician.
Yes.
And he was a creative force. Elvis was creative too, but all of his stuff was written for him, and he was. He wasn't manufactured like in the sense where Frankie Avalon and Fabian were, but he was still manufactured to a certain extent. They were selling an image where Buddy Holly, he wasn't pretty, but he had a certain sound. He had a certain energy. He was innovative, especially for that time. And he says, really, Buddy Holly's really the guy that, more in my vein, he's that's the kind of guy I want to hang out with and talk with and maybe, jam with, so to speak. Elvis, you probably couldn't do that with so much, but Buddy Holly would have been the one for him. He loved Buddy Holly.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And he was a businessman as well. The fact that he was, working at it as the Crickets and Buddy Holly, and he's had a couple record labels. And, there were a lot of very strategic things early on.
He sure was.
I would agree with that. But the idea that, Buddy, of course, died young, that sealed in some ways him. Same with Gene Vincent, because nobody saw them grow old. But here was your dad, who was still performing as a septuagenarian and beyond. And for most people, like I say, even with Elvis, sadly, by the time Elvis's latter years came around, he was pretty much a joke there. Oh, it was just
painful. Those videos floating around from that last year. So why do people post these things? It's really pathetic.
It was.
Like that. And only 42 years of age.
I know.
I mean, come on, he was still a young man.
Well, of course, management just used him up till he was, we can't say enough bad things about Colonel Parker and all of that.
Yeah.
But regardless of why, still, Elvis did become the punchline of a joke. And, of course, his records were selling only country. So to that extent, whoever Priscilla's advisors were to, after death, to be able to turn him into bigger than he ever was in life is pretty amazing. But the fact that your father could withstand all the decades and still have, again, like you say, the Paul McCartneys of the world to this day, the accolades don't stop. So that's a hard thing to pull off.
It is. And you mentioned earlier about, survival. I think, my father always separated his musical life, his career from his home life. I mean, my dad was a very social person, as you remember. We broke bread together many times, and he loved people. But really, when he got done playing, he just couldn't wait to get home and just put his feet up and relax and have a snack and sit in front of the television with my mom and watch some old movies or whatever. He always separated his music life from his home life. And he used to say, you know, a certain amount of success and fame is wonderful, but it rings hollow if you have nothing to come home to. And even when he performed, you know, even like regionally in the Philadelphia area, he would finish a set, and then rather than go sit down and take a rest, he would go from table to table to table and speak and just pose for pictures and just kind of shoot the breeze with his fans. And that was his social life. I mean, he saw his fans and his friends at these venues, and even in England to a lesser extent. I mean, there are theater jobs, so it's tougher to do it there, but he would. He would let greet people backstage and hang around and take pictures and sign things. And people to this day still write to me and tell me how they marveled over that. Your dad always had time, and your mom, too, that they were always there, and they always greeted us, made us feel like we were part of the action, and made us feel like we were the celebrities, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the secret of his success. And it wasn't like a put-up job. That's just who he was. He was that kind of a guy, you know? And people, even where we lived in Delaware County outside of Philadelphia, my dad did a lot of grocery shopping during the day. He would go from store to from the Acme to the the Giant,
or right.
it was Super Fresh, whatever it was. And people just loved greeting him in the aisles and posing for pictures and just chatting with him. He'd go out for a loaf of bread and come back 2 hours later.
Right.
I'd be like, where were you? Said, well, you know, a few people stopped me, and, you know, we were shooting the breeze and then taking pictures and what have you. But that, it was wonderful. That's part of his aura to it. It was always part of who he was, you know, and people love him for that. They loved him for that.
Well, absolutely, and it really inured to his benefit because, as far as I know, your dad was a working musician his entire life. And, of course,
had a day job.
Right,
never.
And that's the point, because what Bernie Lowe and the people at Cameo tried to do was make sure that he'd only have a day job. And, I mean, that was so complete stateside in terms of blocking any exposure in terms of records or television appearances thank God they shot Jamboree beforehand. I thought Jamboree is still my all-time favorite movie. It's the only movie I know that codified payola with all those disc jockeys in it. It's hilarious.
Fun movie to watch. Now, we're coming out of Chicago, right? Right.
Yes, WGN. Absolutely. WGN 720.
Your listeners will probably appreciate this. My father did a big, big show in 57, in May of 57, I think it was, May or June, at the Chicago Opera House.
Uh-huh.
And I think the proceeds grew something like $25,000. That was considered a lot of money back then, you know, for a rock and roll show. So on that show was my father, Eddie Cochran, a very young Brenda Lee, the trumpeter, Al Hirt was on that show, Cab Hunter, the actor who sang occasionally. I'm trying to think who else, too. The Everly brothers and Don Cherry. There were others. But that was at the Chicago Opera House. And who was the MC? And Chicagoans would probably know this. Howard Miller.
Yeah, of course. All right.
Howard Miller. Right?
Yeah.
Sort of the Dick Clark of the Midwest, I guess you'd call him.
Yeah.
Right,
that,
will. Yeah.
That's
so
terrific. Were there any film of any of that at all?
Not that I know of. Oh, Chuck Berry was also on that show, Raleigh.
He should have been, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's funny, I was reading a review. Somebody sent me a review from one of the Chicago papers, and they said the show was great, and it was just still sold out. They said the people that stood out, they named three people. They said Charlie Gracie, Eddie Cochran, and Chuck Berry had an air of showmanship. They were able to ingratiate the crowd and engage the crowd, and they weren't just audacious amateurs. They really connected, and they had some showmanship. They were a presence on stage. Yeah, and I should send you that clip. It's really nice. But that was the Chicago Opera House in May or June of 57 with Howard Miller.
That's wonderful.
What station would he have been on in Chicago? Do you have any idea?
Probably at WLS. But when we're talking 57, that's before Ellis had gone top 40. So I'm gonna find out. I'm gonna try to find out right now. But 57 was a big year because, as your dad would attest, the fair bookers in 57 got into booking rock and roll acts. So suddenly, mm-hmm. in addition to the country performers, you were starting to see a lot of the early rock and rollers. And I'm sure that there were more than a few that your dad did that summer.
Oh, yeah. He played all the major cities in Cleveland, Chicago, and all those towns, Milwaukee, even down south to some degree. But, those are great days. And anyone who lives through that era, was blessed and privileged to have experienced it. I mean, I'm a little too young. I came along right around that time, just after, so I missed it. But if anyone had a chance to go to those programs and enjoy those, that array of talent, just to see 8 or 10 or 12 acts on one show for what, maybe $2.50 or $3. I mean, think about it's amazing.
Now,
they could never pay those acts today.
I'm thinking that in 57, Howard Miller was on WIND.
Okay.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. He was on GN later, but no, I think WIND. And he was on television, too. But for a while, yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'll look that up to confirm it in moments here. But I'm pretty sure I go with WIND. That's my vote. But somebody listening in Chicago could probably fill us in for sure. We're going to get to Steffi in Madison, who's got a call. We're talking to Charlie Gracie Jr. Charlie Gracie and his fabulous life. And now part of a display at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So if you listen to this show, the one thing I know is you love radio. Yeah, or else why would you, right? So you're probably well aware of the Sea Crane Company, but if not, oh man, go to ccradio.com. Bob Crane is just like you and I. He loved radio, and he was just absolutely disgusted with modern radios that had virtually no reception that mattered, particularly on AM. And he decided, you know, I'm going to design something that actually has the reception of radios we used to buy back in the day, and boy, did he. Now, there are a number of them at the Sea Crane Company, and one of them is the CC Radio Solar. And this is a terrific radio because no matter what, it always works. And in a way, it's an emergency radio, and it is great in a crisis because it'll work no matter what. Battery's dead? That's okay. It's got solar power. Didn't put it in the windowsill? The sun's not shining? That's okay. It's got a little hand crank. You can crank it for about 30 seconds. It's going to play for 30 minutes. And it's also got a light. So, you know, power's out. It's at night. What are you reaching for? You're reaching for the radio and the flashlight. Well, you get both with the CC Solar, but what you really get is peace of mind because it is going to work no matter what. Now, here's the deal. Superior reception at excellent audio. So whether it's AM, whether it's FM, whether it's the weather band, and oh yeah, it gets weather alerts too, it's all in there. When all other communication is down, radio will be with you. So check out the CC Radio Solar at ccradio.com or ccrane.com, but ccradio.com. Or give them a call. If you can't go online, they've got the best customer service in the world 24 hours a day right there. They don't outsource it. 800-522-8863. 800-522-TUNE. But if you can go online, you'll not only see great products, but great information too. Take a look at that CC Radio Solar. You tell them Raleigh sent you on WGN Radio.
Well, I always knew I was crazy for you. How'd I know? You thrill me so. If this is love, well, it's fabulous. Your lips close to mine, I get chills up my spine. And when they touch, I thrill so much. If this is love, it's fabulous.
WGN Radio, I'm Raleigh James. And it is fabulous. It's Charlie Gracie. And of course, Butterfly was bigger, but Fabulous was a big hit too. But Butterfly, the huge giant. But as far as I'm concerned, Fabulous was my fave. And I never asked you this, Charlie Jr., but did your dad have a personal fave of anything he did?
Oh, my goodness. I know he liked all the cameo things. To say what you want about Bernie Lowe, he knew how to cut a record.
Yep.
Those songs still sound pristine to this day. I mean,
yep.
You can understand what that's singing. You hear every note on a guitar, every bop-de-wop that Dave Apple and the Applejacks are singing in support. I think he liked some of the rockers, like the flip side of Fabulous, Just Looking could have been an A-side. That was a real rocking piece. And Heart Like a Rock. I think there's a ballad he did called Trying, which was originally hit by the Hilltoppers, I think in 51 or 2. He was on the Alex Wood cameo then, so I think it was one of the last things he recorded with them, because Bernie said, well, we have a side that's like, what do you want to do, Charlie? Whatever. He says, I want to do Trying. All right, we'll do it. They put together an arrangement and they did it. And it came off pretty well. It's, pretty powerful vocal performance by my dad. But again, he liked to be versatile. He liked to rock, but he also liked to sing. And my father was influenced, you know, coming up in the late 40s, early 50s. Johnny Ray was all the rage then. By the way, Johnny Ray should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, I agree. Not, but, now, by the way, we're coming down to the waning moments, and Stephanie wants to get in here. So, Stephanie, welcome back.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hey. Charlie Jr. and Raleigh, I just wanted to say my husband and I saw your dad at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake, Iowa. We go every year to the tribute concerts for Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper. And you know, when people die that young, it's sad they're so young. We have a T-shirt, a Ritchie Valens T-shirt, Forever 17. I mean, you know, but your dad was wonderful. He was absolutely, absolutely fantastic. And I still had clearer vision then. I've lost a lot of my sight. So, but he had a wonderful blue suit. He sounded great. He was a wonderful performer. And he also, my husband saw him, their rockabilly festivals at the Oneida Casino in Green Bay. And your dad was at one of them. He couldn't remember which year, but I think we might have seen him at Clear Lake in 07.
I can tell you, he was there in 2002, and he was there in 2007 the second time.
So there you go.
I was there for both of them. They were riveting. That was a riveting week with all those great performers there. My gosh, it was wonderful.
All right, Stephanie, thank you for calling.
Well, you are so welcome. Bye-bye, guys. Thanks a lot.
And we'll have to do this again, Charlie, because, of course, now people are lining up. But too bad you missed the hour. It will it will replay online in perpetuity. And I will have I'll hold you to that. But
by the way, Raleigh, Howard was on WIND.
Okay.
I'm looking at the program right now.
Yep. Good deal. I figured, as I was thinking, it had to be WIND. Good. Well, all right. So I'm glad we cleared that up. All right, so we'll do it again soon, and thank you, and hopefully everyone will see the Ravon exhibit soon.
Yes.
All right. So Charlie Jr., of course, Charlie Gracie, and can't say enough about Charlie and his family and his music and his guitar work and on and on. We got another 2 hours to talk about whatever's on your mind. I'll make sure it's on mine right here on WGN Radio.